And so I'm very pleased to chair this third panel, which will be on diasporas, community, and identity. Coming out of yesterday's discussions, this panel will follow a similar dynamic, as it'll address these questions from artistic perspectives, from academic and research perspectives, to sort of come at them from a variety of different angles. So I'm very pleased to first introduce our first speaker, which is Gavin Maitland, who he is a freelance researcher and lecturer in the UK. He has a master's in photographic history and practice from De Montfort University, Leicester, and a second master's of information management and preservation from the University of Glasgow. He has written and lectured on a range of topics, but with a particular focus on vernacular, material, and archival dimension of photographs and photographic practices. His paper today is Things We Lost in the Fire, Images from the Bamboo Club, 1966 to 1977. So I welcome him.
Hi there. Thank you very much for having me. In this paper, I would like to discuss the emergence of Black British identity among a small group of young West Indian men and women in Bristol, England, in the 1960s and 70s. Through this, I will discuss the archive of the Bamboo Club, Bristol's first social club created specifically for the cultural and social needs of the West Indian community, which opened its doors on the 28th of October, 1966. The archive of the Bamboo Club is now held within the Bristol Records Office as part of the Bristol Black Archives Partnership, which was set up in March 2007 with the intention of promoting the use of archives and depositories relating to Black British social history in Bristol, and encourages people to deposit their own papers, documents, photographs, film, and personal archives within its care. Seemingly incomplete, the ephemeral nature of these photographs have made it easy for them to become lost within the archive, their cumulative potential overlooked. Here I argue that in the ephemerality of these images lie clues in which we begin to forensically rebuild the Bamboo Club, locating it within history and our imagination. The images that make up this archive can show us how people lived, laughed, and loved long ago in the 20th century. As I entered through the doors of the archive, the absence of what was lost to history was palpable. The archive of the Bamboo Club was deposited to the Bristol Black Archive Partnership by Tony Bullimore, who had been the proprietor and license holder of the club throughout its 11-year run. Within the images and records of this archive, it becomes clear that, although white and British, not only is Mr. Bullimore the force around which all the other members collect, but that he has a vested interest in the successful running of the club, not merely as a commercial enterprise, but more specifically to further the cultural success of the West Indian community in Bristol during this time. As such, throughout this paper, we will be hearing from and seeing much of Tony Bullimore as he and his wife, Lalelle, pictured next to him, as their presence are prevalent throughout the imagery which I will be discussing. In fact, Tony and Lalelle's presence is the string that ties the narrative of the Bamboo Club together. Whether it is a young Tony, still in his 20s, posing in a publicity shot with one of the first bands he managed, or holding a record in front of an early reggae sound system in the basement of the club, or Lalelle pictured outside the club, shopping in hand, a snapshot which mimics one that might be taken outside a young couple's first home, or eight, in one of the final images in the archive, sat broken and exhausted outside the gutted remains of the club, destroyed by fire in a suspected racist attack in December 1977. The prevalent image of Britain during the war years is of British culture as being decidedly working class and white. The patriotism that goes with defending one's country, whether overseas or at home during wartime, is reflected back on itself, strengthening the notion of a pre-multicultural Britishness and a fear of the invading other. Yet during the war, a great percentage of servicemen representing Great Britain were from its colonies, many of which were established more than 200 years prior. After the war, ostensibly to show its gratitude for their bravery and commitment, the government opened its doors to its colonial subjects from the West Indies and India for a number of years from 1948. The loosening of the Immigration Act encouraged Britain's Commonwealth subjects to board ships in search of employment, sending for wives and family once work had been found. Through these generations, a culture was born, separate from that of their homeland, but fused inextricably with the culture of what they called the mother country. In recent years in Britain, the symbolism of the SS Empire Windrush and the disembarkation of the first 492 immigrants from Jamaica on the 22nd of June 1948 has come to stand metonymically for the notion of a black British identity and sometimes for cultural heritage as a whole. The relationship between the symbolic arrival of the Windrush and the way in which the past is repositioned in history has come to stand for a grand myth of post-war migration in which an identity of the past has been thrust upon the emergent West Indian community in order that it might serve cultural capital in the present. Through the sustained reiteration of facts, the place, Tilbury, the ship, the Windrush, and the date, 22nd of June 1948, the symbolic imagery of dapper young West Indian men and women dressed in their finest clothes has been played out within Britain's cultural imagination as a ritualized performance of the past through the iconography of photography. Yet the disembarkation of the 492 immigrants is not quite the profound moment of cultural change it is so often depicted as, but rather a homogenization of smaller events, the imagery of which, often mislabeled, has been forced to fit into a preferred notion of an originary moment of post-colonial diaspora. This narrative is confusing because, on one hand, it seeks to create a singular moment in which to be celebrated as a vindication of the treatment of Africans at the hands of British slaveholders in the West Indies 200 years prior. And for that, it should be celebrated. But it also serves an all too simple narrative which destabilizes the more powerful and far more complex story of historical notions of race and power in the West prior to the 19th century. In reality, Great Britain's complicated relationship to race and to questions of what it means to be truly British predates the convenient disembarkation narrative of the Windrush by at least 100 years. Caroline Bressy has pointed to a paradox where the lack of data recording in early census forms failed to highlight the ethnicity of a person of the 19th century, making it harder to see precisely how many black people made up Victorian society. A paradox that conveniently leads to a whitening of the black community, her quotes, in Britain during this period by erasing any claim to a historical black presence in England prior to 1948, despite evidence to the contrary. She asks whether these inconsistencies provide us with the methodological tools to aid in our understanding of race as a social construction within British history. To counter this, Bressy set up the website Black Londoners 1800 to 1900 through the Equiano Centre in order to counter the notion that British black history begins with the shorthand symbolic usage of the Windrush. Seeking to physically map out sightings of black Victorians from records within British archives, Bressy has created a meta-textual recreation of Victorian London in which she invites participation from genealogists, family and local historians, as well as the general public, to add to from their own research. Bressy suggests that we need to begin to challenge the homogenous nature of race in the British historical imagination, stating that, quote, what we can no longer assume is that everyone in the archives who is not allocated another colour is white, end quote. Recent rethinking such as this has resulted in manifold ways in which museums and archives in recent years have attempted to be considerate towards Britain's multiculturalism whilst acknowledging and owning up to its own bloody past. Gareth Griffiths, former museum director of Bristol's Empire and Commonwealth Museum, stated in a New York Times interview, "It is enough that we don't step back from the most uncomfortable periods of our national history and don't hide and duck behind the realities of history. The British Empire is now a black hole in history and few dare look into its depths." Photographic images do not have a voice of their own. They do not sit idly and speak to us. It is we who must interrogate them to enter the images, as it is the cultural accumulation of knowledge which we bring to photographs that make them historically significant. When one is trying to make sense of an already partial archive, consisting of little documentation and only few visual clues, the researcher is trying to piece together a narrative. when the ability to access the document in question is hampered by means that are constrictive and essentially bureaucratic, then the ability to interrogate the immateriality of the document as it was intended to interrogate its functional history is hampered also. One of the ways in which I found myself confronted with the structuralized relationship of the archive of the Bamboo Club to the image as a socially salient document was in the expectation of accepting substandard materials with which I was expected to conduct my research. When I first approached the desk of the archive of the Bristol Records Office, I was told that I could not see the archive as it was too fire damaged to be handled. I was told that copies had been made of some of the items and I could see those. In this respect, I found that the level of control instilled over the ways in which I viewed and had access to the archive of the Bamboo Club affected the indexical function of the document, as too did my reading of it, both as an archive of Black British history and as a socially salient document, became entangled and confused with what was not there and what could not be read. This obfuscation of the social function of the photograph, interestingly, further sets to obliterate and confuse an alternative and perhaps more true account of Black British identity in the 1960s and 70s. Upon my second visit to the archive, I was miraculously allowed by another archivist to view the complete original set of documents and material related to the Bamboo Club. John Berger has stated that photographs themselves do not preserve meaning. Meaning is the result of understanding functions. And as such, the power of a photograph as a socially salient object is informed by its use through time, while the material characteristics of the photograph both signal and enforce different expectations and use patterns. Therefore, a photograph only becomes a document when it is tethered to its functional context and the informational value of a photograph changes according to the context in which it is placed. Therefore, it is the social and commercial function of photographs that form part of a wider commercial construction within society. These tools can be extrapolated and used in the context of any historical reconstruction where perhaps the researcher is faced with only fragments of history or ephemera. As Michael Baxendale has stated, approached in the proper way, the pictures become documents as valid as any charter or parish roll. By the mid-1960s, the reproductive capabilities of modern printing methods allowed that photographs could be reproduced in cheaper and cheaper ways, enabling the production of more images for a larger audience. By understanding the technical context of their production history, we can begin to see the historical context in which they were produced. In this sense, an examination of the commercial intent of the photographs within the Bamboo Club of the 1960s might reveal a process of inquiry which can open a greater understanding of the function of the club as a commercial and cultural venture. Susan Sontag has written that photography has largely been practiced as a social right, a defence against anxiety and a tool of power by those wanting to fit in and conform within the community. With this in mind and with a consideration toward other non-photographic items within the archive of the Bamboo Club, we can trace the standing of the club and the members of its committee, as well as the social aspirations towards acceptance within the wider Bristol community. Pierre Bourdieu saw a social engagement with photography which represented distinctions between class levels within French society of the 1950s and 60s. Bourdieu recognised that the wider availability of photography in France after the war, in which the, quote, photographic image is adopted insofar that it can be accorded a social function, end quote, represented a form of social aspiration within various levels of society, in which the middle classes saw it as a representative of social respectability. By acknowledging and engaging with the social rules and functions which govern their production, i.e. the practice of photography within set social situations, at the beach, in front of memorials, with children, friends, wives, etc., photographs represent the result of these aspirations, ensuring the maker's inclusion into the homogeneity of the community. As Bourdieu states, the camera is part of a lifestyle based on house, garden and car, which moulds the aspirations of the suburban nations of the prosperous West, end quote. As Sontag and O'Donnell have argued, photography strives towards a creative fantasy in which an absence of negative or critical depictions of the subject exist in the hope that through a celebration of the mundane and homogenous, the community at large will be more accepting towards the outsider and their significant others. These statements are particularly pertinent when applied to the context of the Bamboo Club. When understanding the technical context of their production history, we can begin to see the historical context in which they were produced. In this sense, an examination of the commercial intent of the photographs within the Bamboo Club of the 1960s might reveal a process of inquiry which can open a greater understanding of the function of the club as a commercial and cultural venture. Attempts at a favourable perception within Bristol are certainly notable. When looking at the minutes of the meeting and from the many entries, it is clear that the club was intended not only as a nightclub, but as a centre where every member of the West Indian community could find a place and feel at home, and many of these images reflect the attitude held in the minutes of the committee. Reading within these minutes, frequent mention is made to the Bristol Evening News and the way in which the commissioning of a photographer might help in the promotion of the club. There are numerous images among the archive which are stamped on the back with the press stamp of the paper and which variously show the cultural capital of the club through promotional images such as the opening night and awards being given and celebrations of cricket games. There is intimation within the minutes that members of the club may have ties with the newspaper, and it is here that we begin to uncover the agency of the photograph as a form of cultural capital which initiate and exemplify social relations as discussed above. We can imagine that the committee for the Bamboo Club, almost all of whom would have been first-generation British-born, were concerned not only with the legitimate running of the club as a business, but as a cultural centre promoting good racial relations within Bristol and the UK. The archive of photographs that remain feature not only depictions of the routine of life within the club, of dances, cricket club celebrations, local press shots, but also many of the original portraits and signed photographs that adorn the walls and the bar of these same images, creating a sense of double indexicality which embody the material and effective aspects of much late writing on the history of photography. As Joan Schwartz has shown, interrogating the photograph as an archival document can open an understanding of the continuum of dialogue between image and the culture of use. Regarding this archive, the ephemeral nature of many of these images as industrial working images, as well as socially salient portraits, attest to their varying intended uses. Depicting the examples of newly adopted cultural, social etiquette and dress, often against the trauma of displacement and alienation that frequently figures into the migrant experience. The photographs of the Bamboo Club raise questions of belonging and nationalism within the Black British experience through the industrial and social processes of the British photographic industry. I just want to say that this paper is part of a much, much larger piece of work, so it's taken me quite some time to edit this down into a convenient source. Obviously, it seems ironic that I'm talking about Black British history through images mostly of a white British male, as I said, partly because Tony and his wife, Lalelle, provide the narrative thread that helps us construct this history. I think without them, it would be harder to find a story within this archive. I would love to be able to go into the lives of each separate member which made up the committee, some of whom had an incredibly important role to play in the burgeoning civil rights values in Bristol, not least of which the Bristol bus boycott, which was a boycott against the local bus services employing Black and Indian drivers, which was inspired by the civil rights movement only a few years before that in the US. What is perhaps difficult to see when viewed independent of each other, particularly when one's viewing experience is blocked or obscured, as previously discussed, is that viewed collectively, the ephemeral nature of these images form part of a wider system of commercial or industrial forms of communication. Communication that ranges from photographs taken with the intention of various kinds of newspaper publication to photographs intended for the self-promotion of the club, not only to newspapers but also to other clubs and agencies, as well as promotional images that would have been sent to the club by outside agencies and promoters. What did we lose in the fire? What indeed did we gain? Can absence make up an archive? Can ideas? Perhaps what we lost in the fire is what we can reconstruct from memory. But as even this option fades into history, we are left with little more than fragments. We can imagine that the Bamboo Club, lost to the fire of 1977, forcefully presents an absence in the here and now, maintaining its presence through the archive that it has left behind. Recalling Roland Barthes' notion of that which has been, the archive of the Bamboo Club achieves through what Ilkka Runia calls the act of artistic transubstantiation, the metaphysical, metaphorical state of a living museum to the lives and experiences of what it meant to be a black man or woman in the United Kingdom during the 1960s and 70s. In this context, Ilkka Runia's notion of presence and James Boone's idea of place as living museum, living archive, living history is especially potent in this context. And I think that for an immigrant population that has frequently and repeatedly been denied a voice or had a convenient narrative thrust upon them, the notion of the Bamboo Club as a living memorial to the people that founded her and danced within her rooms is an especially potent one. The idea of an idea floats in space and time continuously in the unrepresented way that the past exists in the present. In this way, through the repositioning of our notion of the past, the notion of presence moves from the literal to the figurative, so that through the continual forms of expression that are employed to represent it, seen most explicitly in monuments, statues, and commemoration, the past continues to exist in the presence once it is past. Like so many physical structures that bear the traces of the past, the building that once was the Bamboo Club has become a haunted house. It is cold and empty throughout, but what has been left behind are the venerable traces that make up the last vestiges of the history of a place. What once housed so much life, love, and laughter for an immigrant population away from the 1,000 daily pinpricks of hate they were otherwise forced to endure on the streets of Bristol in the mid-1960s. As we progress through the 21st century and continue to embrace and embody practices that disconnect us increasingly from a sense of physical connection, all that we have left are the venerable traces of what it was to be alive at a time in a place, through something which was at once everywhere we looked. Thought of as humdrum and ugly as a postage stamp, the paper snapshot photograph has become as rare yet as important as a document or an artifact from hundreds of years ago. As a proof in point, snapshot photography and its ephemeral relations worked as a binding social force and maligned communities within the United Kingdom during the post-war years. An archive such as this should be heralded as a social document of an important period in our shared history and used in showing the greater good of understanding the social function and social life of photographs in the archives. The way in which the legacies and archives belonging to these communities have been treated within archives which claim to act as holdings for the deposits of documents relating to black visual culture. Thank you.